On Christmas Day 2009, Larry Regal, a quiet, dependable 57-year-old from Yakima, Washington, called his family to say he'd join them the next morning. He never showed up. No goodbyes, no phone calls, just silence. Days later, his girlfriend, Ladina Mann, told police he'd gone to the coast, something Larry reportedly hated. Then her story changed, again and again. Within weeks, she was caught using his EBT card. Two unknown men were seen clearing out Larry's home, and yet no body was found. No one was charged. And the official investigation stalled for over a decade. Now, with new investigators, fresh eyes, and growing public pressure, the cold case is heating up again. But one question still haunts everyone. What really happened to Larry Regal? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Christmas That Went Silent. Yakima, Washington. A town nestled in the shadows of the Cascades. Cold winters, warm summers, and a community where people tend to know your name, even if they don't always know your secrets. For Larry Regal, Christmas Day, 2009, started like any other holiday. He was 57 years old, a creature of habit. Known for being generous with his time, soft-spoken, and close with his family, Larry wasn't the type to break plans, especially not on Christmas. That afternoon, Larry called his sister. They chatted briefly. He promised he'd stop by the next day to spend time with everyone. There was no urgency in his voice, no hint that something was wrong. Just the familiar, comforting cadence they all knew. But that was the last time anyone in his family would ever hear from him. When December 26th came and Larry didn't show, concern began to build. By December 27th, worry turned into fear. He wasn't answering his phone. He hadn't shown up to work. And his car, usually parked in its spot near his home, was missing. For a man who was deeply attached to his routines, this wasn't just strange. It was alarming. Larry lived with his longtime girlfriend, Ladina Mann, in a modest house on the edge of town. They'd had their ups and downs, like most couples, but Larry's family had always found Ladina difficult, private, occasionally defensive. Still, no one expected what came next. When Larry's sister called Ladina to ask if she'd seen him, Ladina's answer was curt. She said Larry had taken off, gone to the coast for a few days to clear his head. That didn't sit right. Larry wasn't the type to take sudden trips, least of all to the coast, a place he reportedly hated. He found it cold, windy, lonely, the kind of place you visit if you have no intention of being found. But the alarm didn't ring loud enough at first. After all, Larry was an adult. He had the right to disappear, technically. So for a few more days, the family waited. Then everything changed, January 4th, 2010. Ladina showed up at a local hospital. She claimed Larry had returned home the night before. According to her, they got into an argument that turned violent. Larry allegedly assaulted her, then stormed out again and never came back. She didn't have injuries to match the claim. No police report had been filed at the time of the supposed assault. And when asked what direction Larry had gone or what he'd said before leaving, Ladina simply shrugged. The timeline didn't add up. There were no witnesses. No one else had seen or heard from Larry since Christmas Day, and that's when his family knew something was terribly wrong. They filed a missing persons report on January 6th. Police visited the home. There were no signs of forced entry, no blood, no disturbance. But one detail stuck out. A neighbor claimed to have seen two unidentified men removing items from the house just days after Christmas. Large objects loaded into a van. The kind of thing you might do if someone was leaving, or being erased. Investigators noted the statement, but there was no follow-up, no names, no surveillance footage, just a vague report from someone who thought it looked odd. It wasn't enough to open a criminal case. Not yet. Still, Larry's family pressed for answers. And then came the next bombshell. Financial records revealed that Larry's EBT card was being used repeatedly in the days and weeks following his disappearance. Surveillance footage was inconclusive, but transaction locations suggested someone local was swiping the card. When questioned, Ladina admitted she'd been using it. Her excuse? She said Larry gave her permission before he vanished. The authorities didn't buy it. Ladina Mann was charged with welfare fraud, perjury, and filing false verification statements. The charges, however, would later be dropped after she agreed to enter a diversion program and repay the stolen funds. In the eyes of the law, that closed the book on the financial misconduct, but for Larry's family, it only deepened their suspicions. Why would a woman claiming to have been abused and abandoned keep spending her missing partner's money? Why were her stories changing every time she was questioned? And why wasn't the police department taking a harder look? The investigation stagnated for years. No new tips, no body, no suspects. Yakima police kept the case open, but cold was an understatement. It was frigid, icy, a file collecting dust while Larry's family begged for someone to listen. They distributed flyers, held vigils, offered a $25,000 reward. They even hired private investigators, but each effort led back to the same wall of silence. Until 2025, more than 15 years after Larry vanished, a renewed wave of attention hit the case. Two podcast episodes aired on The Vanished, titled Shifting Narratives and Dusting Off the Case. Both zeroed in on Ladina's shifting timelines, the uninvestigated sighting of the two unknown movers, and the financial trail she left behind. The exposure worked. In early 2025, Yakima police assigned a new lead investigator, Detective Nolan Wentz. Known for his persistence in cold cases, Wentz reopened every file, re-interviewed neighbors, combed through old surveillance logs, and began what Larry's family had hoped for all along, a true investigation. Cadaver dogs were brought to the property. Items removed from the home back in 2010 were tracked down and tested. Forensics reanalyzed. But as of mid-2025, no body, no murder charge, no closure. Still, something had shifted. People were finally asking the hard questions. Back in 2009, Larry Regal was just another man preparing for the holidays. Today, he's the center of one of Yakima's most mysterious and suspicious disappearances. Was it a domestic incident covered up with lies? Was it a premeditated vanishing act? Or was there a darker conspiracy at play, one involving more people than anyone ever dared imagine? As the new investigation moves forward, Larry's family holds on to one thing. Hope. Hope that someone will talk. That someone saw something. That the silence that's lasted since that cold December day will finally, finally be broken. Because Larry didn't just walk away. Something happened. And someone knows the truth. Chapter 2, The Woman Who Changed Her Story. From the outside, Ladina Mann didn't fit the profile of someone capable of making a man vanish. She was quiet, middle-aged, known to a few neighbors, but not exactly liked. Most people in Yakima barely remembered her name until Larry Regal disappeared. After that, her presence became a central knot in a web of contradictions, whispers, and suspicion. When investigators first interviewed her, Ladina's tone was flat, emotionless. She claimed Larry left on his own, said he needed space, said he was going to the coast. That was her word, coast. The problem? Larry hated the coast. Everyone close to him knew it. Cold water, harsh wind, too far, too empty. He didn't travel much, and certainly not without telling someone. But she insisted, at least, at first. A few days later, the story shifted. Now, she said, Larry did return home. But they argued. She said he became violent, that he hit her, that he stormed off again, and that was the last time she saw him. But something in her version felt off. There were no bruises, no police report filed that night, no medical evidence, no broken items in the house, and again, no witnesses. Not a single person could verify that Larry came back after Christmas Day. It wasn't just the inconsistencies. It was the timing. Her new version of events came only after Larry's family reported him missing and questioned her claims. It smelled like panic, like she was trying to cover up a lie she couldn't keep straight. Detective Wentz would later call her timeline fractured fiction. What really put Ladina under the microscope, though, wasn't the broken timeline. It was the money. Larry had an EBT card. He wasn't wealthy, but he got by. After he disappeared, charges continued to show up, groceries, gas, small purchases across Yakima. The transactions weren't huge, but they were active. Someone was swiping that card. Investigators tracked the locations and eventually confronted Ladina. She admitted it, claimed Larry told her to use it while he was gone. Gone where? And for how long? There were no texts, no emails, no physical notes, just her word. A word that was already starting to crumble. Prosecutors filed charges. Welfare fraud, false verification, perjury. The amounts weren't enough for prison time, but they were enough to paint a picture of someone exploiting a man who could no longer speak for himself. She entered a diversion program, repaid what she owed, and walked away legally clear. But the stain on her credibility was permanent. Larry's family believed this was her way of testing the limits, to see how long she could keep up the illusion before someone looked closer. And the truth was, for a long time, no one did. One Yakima detective involved early in the case said something chilling off the record. If Larry had been a rich man, this would have been national news. Instead, the case quietly slipped through the cracks of an overworked, underfunded department. A man disappears. His girlfriend changes her story. She spends his benefits. Two unknown men are seen clearing out his house, and still, nothing, no arrest, no body, no answers. For Larry's sister, Karen Regal, the system's silence was unbearable. Karen remembered her brother as a man who always called. Birthdays, anniversaries, random Mondays. He'd check in, make jokes, ask about the kids. When he didn't call after Christmas, she knew it wasn't just a delay, it was wrong. She became the loudest voice in the search for answers. She contacted every media outlet she could think of, drove back and forth from Oregon to Yakima, made flyers, built a digital timeline of events. She tracked bank activity. She posted on forums. She even contacted true crime podcasts. And finally, someone listened. In May 2025, the Vanished podcast aired two full episodes on Larry's case. The episodes, Shifting Narratives and Dusting Off the Case, broke down the timeline piece by piece. They featured interviews with Karen, former neighbors, and cold case experts. The story painted Ladina as a person of interest, even though the police had never officially labeled her as such. More disturbingly, the podcast revealed an eyewitness account that had gone virtually ignored for years. A neighbor claimed they saw two unidentified men moving boxes and furniture out of Larry's home in the days after Christmas 2009. They didn't recognize the men. One wore a heavy work jacket and gloves. The other had a neck tattoo. They loaded a van for nearly an hour, then drove off. Karen had begged police to identify the men, check traffic cameras, ask for public tips. Nothing came of it. The Vanished amplified those questions to a nationwide audience, and with it came renewed pressure on Yakima authorities. By early summer 2025, the department reopened the file. Enter Detective Nolan Wentz, former military, sharp, methodical, known for solving a 17-year-old cold case involving a missing teenager in Ellensburg. Wentz took one look at the file and said, "There's something wrong here. Too much smoke for there to be no fire." He started with Ladina, brought her in, interviewed her again. Her story, again, shifted slightly. She couldn't remember exact dates. She couldn't say whether Larry left wearing a coat. She didn't recall what he was carrying. When asked what she did the day after he supposedly left, she fumbled, confused errands, misremembered timelines. To Wentz, it sounded rehearsed, over-rehearsed. He reviewed old evidence, he looked at her financials, he cross-referenced phone records, receipts, ATM withdrawals. He pulled every report on property damage, domestic disturbance, and anonymous tips filed near their address in the months after Larry vanished. He also looked into Ladina's background. What he found raised more red flags. Before Larry, she had been involved in two domestic disputes, both quietly resolved without charges. She'd filed police reports against previous partners, but in both cases, the men denied the claims and said she had fabricated threats for attention. One even filed a counterclaim, accusing her of manipulation and setting him up. Wentz documented it all. It didn't prove guilt, but it established a pattern. She had used allegations before, and she had benefited from silence before. Now, Wentz had to find something concrete, a trail, a message, a trace of Larry that hadn't yet been erased. He turned his attention to the home. Ladina no longer lived there. The house had been sold in 2016 to a young couple who allowed the police to conduct a full cadaver dog sweep. The dogs picked up a faint signal in the crawl space, near the furnace. Soil samples were taken, nothing definitive, but it gave Wentz what he needed to escalate the case, probable cause for a broader forensic review. He ordered analysis of furniture that had once been inside the home, pieces retrieved from storage units that Karen had managed to trace back to Ladina. Most had been scrubbed clean. But one recliner, found in a Goodwill drop box, tested positive for old blood traces, too degraded for DNA confirmation. But a chilling discovery, nonetheless. For the first time in 15 years, the case felt alive again. And so did the family's hope. But the deeper Wentz dug, the more dangerous the silence became. Old names resurfaced, new threats emerged. And in the next chapter, Wentz begins to uncover a network of secrets far beyond what anyone expected. A quiet corruption hiding beneath the surface of a small town with too much to lose. Chapter 3. A Vanishing Wrapped in Silence. Detective Nolan Wentz stared at the evidence board, his fingers rhythmically tapping a pen against his notepad. Every photo, every report, every statement tied to Larry Regal's name was now pinned to the wall of his tiny cold case unit. But what stood out to Wentz more than any missing detail was the unnatural absence of noise. This wasn't just a man who disappeared. This was a man who was disappeared. Methodically, quietly, and with enough misdirection to keep the truth hidden for over a decade. Wentz returned to the original witness report. The neighbor who claimed to have seen two men moving items out of Larry's home in the days following Christmas 2009. The men were never identified. No photos, no truck plate numbers. The description was vague, and the report had never been followed up. The detective knocked on that neighbor's door in March 2025. A retired machinist named Ed Curran, now 81, opened the door cautiously. About time someone came back around, Ed said. Wentz showed him the old police sketch of the house and asked him to walk through what he remembered. They weren't movers, Ed muttered. Didn't have uniforms. No company name on the van. One of them smoked like a chimney. Nervous energy. The other was tall, maybe 6'2". Had a tattoo here. He tapped the side of his neck. Didn't feel right. Did they talk to anyone? Wentz asked. Nope. Just loaded up furniture and left. I yelled out to ask what they were doing, and the tall one looked over. Then they got in and drove off fast. There was no surveillance on that side of the street in 2009. But now, at least, Wentz had a better description. He entered both into the regional gang database and state criminal registry. Nothing matched. Yet. Next, Wentz re-examined Larry's phone records. His final confirmed call was to his sister at around 4:12 p.m. on December 25th. After that, no outgoing activity, no voicemail, no texts. But there was one incoming call at 6:43 p.m. from a blocked number. It lasted 11 seconds. The call was never returned. Wentz suspected it may have been spoofed, a burner phone possibly, but tracing it in 2025 from a 2009 record was almost impossible. Still, the timing was too perfect to ignore. If someone lured Larry somewhere, that might have been the trigger. Wentz requested tower data. It took a few weeks. When it arrived, he was stunned. The tower pinged from a location within two blocks of Larry's home. That suggested one of two things. Either Larry received a call from inside the neighborhood, or the person calling him was already nearby. At the same time, Wentz asked Karen Regal to revisit the storage unit where she had saved several of Larry's belongings. Among them were old journals, stacks of paperwork, and a locked filing cabinet she had never been able to open. Larry had always been private with finances. Wentz called in a locksmith. Inside the cabinet were folders of hand-labeled receipts, correspondence, and notes, meticulously sorted. One folder stood out. It was labeled in Larry's handwriting, LM, keep eyes open. Inside were notes tracking purchases Ladina had made in his name, unauthorized withdrawals, letters she sent to a friend requesting help with money. It looked like Larry had already been documenting possible financial abuse before he disappeared. Even more damning, one note read, "If something happens to me, check the receipts. I know she's hiding something. I'm not crazy." It was dated December 19th, 2009. 6 days before he vanished. That note was the clearest red flag Wentz had ever seen, a near-death warning written by a man who likely feared what was coming. It changed the tone of the case entirely. He filed an affidavit for a full forensic financial audit of both Larry's and Ladina's bank activity during November and December 2009. The results painted a damning timeline. December 17th, $300 was withdrawn from Larry's account at a gas station ATM. December 21st, a $900 transfer went to a second account Larry did not own, an account later tied to Ladina's adult son, who had a past arrest record. December 23rd, a cash deposit of $2,000 into Ladina's account. December 27th, EBT card used in a grocery store. By Ladina. January 2nd. The same card used again, while Larry was still officially away. Wentz now had financial motive, circumstantial evidence, and the beginnings of a conspiracy. But he still didn't have a body, or hard proof of a crime. That's when he decided to try something unconventional, anonymous public pressure. He partnered with the Vanished podcast producers to release a follow-up episode titled Larry's Last Clue. In it, they revealed new information including the Keep Eyes Open note and the timeline of financial abuse. No names were mentioned, no accusations made, but the message was clear. The walls were closing in. 3 days after the episode aired, a letter arrived at the Yakima PD, addressed to Wentz by name. Typed, no return address. It read, you're looking in the right place, but there's more under the shed. 2009, January. Look for the blue tarp. It was unsigned. Wentz immediately secured a warrant to search the shed behind Larry's old house. The property had been sold and renovated over the years, but the shed remained unchanged, a rotting wooden structure forgotten in the backyard. Officers pulled up floorboards. Beneath them, in a shallow depression covered in soil and mold, they found a weathered blue tarp. Inside were scraps of blood-stained fabric, bones too decayed for immediate identification, and what appeared to be the frame of a wristwatch, later confirmed as the model Larry wore daily. Testing began immediately. Cadaver dogs reacted strongly. DNA results would take time, but the odds were suddenly no longer in Ladina's favor. Wentz held a press conference the next morning. He didn't name suspects, but he confirmed the discovery of biological evidence consistent with the timeline and last known location of Larry Regal. The news rippled through Yakima. People who hadn't spoken about Larry in years were suddenly watching every update. Old neighbors called the tip line. Former co-workers came forward with memories. Even a local pastor shared an eerie confession that Ladina had once asked him, quietly, if forgiveness could come without a body. The silence was finally breaking, but as Wentz would soon learn, the closer he got to answers, the more dangerous the shadows became. Because someone had waited a long time for this case to disappear, and they weren't going to let it resurface without a fight. Chapter 4, The Blue Tarp Secret. By the time the forensics team arrived at the shed, the blue tarp had already been sealed and secured in a climate-controlled evidence locker. Every inch of it was photographed, catalogued, and sent to the Washington State Crime Lab. But for Detective Nolan Wentz, that tarp was more than evidence. It was a turning point. What had once been a missing persons case had now shifted into probable homicide. Inside the tarp were three key pieces, a fragment of a denim shirt soaked in dried blood. Bone shards, likely ribs and phalanges. A steel wristwatch casing, scratched but intact. The lab confirmed what Wentz had feared. The blood matched Larry Regal, the bones were human. And the watch model? It was the exact style Larry had worn every day for nearly 20 years. His sister, Karen, identified it immediately from photos. Silver, with a black face, a small dent near the clasp. The discovery electrified the department and rattled the town. This wasn't just a missing person anymore. It was a murder scene, one that had been hidden in plain sight, just feet from where Larry had lived, from where his girlfriend had lived, and from where someone had silently cleaned up the evidence for 15 long years. Wentz called Karen personally. He told her the news gently but without sugarcoating it. I need you to prepare for the fact that we may never recover Larry's whole body, he said, but we've got enough to finally pursue this the right way. Karen didn't cry. She just breathed, long and slow, like she'd been holding that breath for over a decade. He's not forgotten anymore, she said. Wentz knew what came next would define not only the case, but his career. He assembled his task force, pulled every known interaction Larry had in the weeks before Christmas 2009, cross-referenced financial data, began identifying and interviewing Ladina Mann's entire known circle, including estranged relatives and past co-workers. And then he got a hit. One name came up again and again. Marcus Mick Delgado, Ladina's adult son. On the surface, Mick was a nobody, occasional labor jobs, prior record for minor theft, and known for bouncing from place to place. But what made Wentz stop cold was the $900 transfer made from Larry's account to an unknown routing number on December 21st, 2009. Bank subpoenas confirmed the account belonged to Mick. When confronted, Mick claimed he never got the money. "My mom probably used my name or info or something," he said in a taped interview. "She always did stuff like that." But Wentz didn't believe him. He requested surveillance footage from the ATM tied to the transfer. The footage, blurry and old, didn't show a clear face. But the tattoo on the man's neck? Clear enough. It matched the old neighbor's description of the man seen removing items from Larry's house. Mick Delgado had just become a person of interest. The next piece was motive. What reason did Ladina, or Mick, have to make Larry vanish? Wentz retraced the timeline of Larry's life in the final months of 2009. What emerged was a picture of a man quietly preparing to cut ties. Friends said he had become withdrawn. He'd mentioned wanting to make changes, get his own place again. Some recalled him saying, "I'm not going to be taken advantage of anymore." Then, Wentz discovered something else. Larry had been in contact with an attorney in early December. The purpose? To change his will. The new will would have excluded Ladina completely, transferring any assets to his siblings. It was drafted, notarized, and ready to be signed on December 28, 2009, 3 days after he was last seen alive. Wentz now had a potential financial motive, a forensic match, and a direct connection between Ladina's family and Larry's assets. He knew he had to move carefully. Instead of approaching Ladina directly, Wentz returned to the Vanished podcast. He agreed to appear in a third episode titled The Blue Tarp Break. In it, he revealed, without naming suspects, that a tip had led to the discovery of biological evidence and that the case was now an active homicide investigation. He hoped the pressure would squeeze someone. It did. 4 days after the episode aired, a former friend of Mick Delgado reached out. She requested anonymity but gave a sworn affidavit. She said Mick had shown up at her apartment shaking and paranoid a few days after Christmas in 2009. He told her he saw something he wasn't supposed to see and that mom's boyfriend ain't coming back. She hadn't gone to police because she didn't want to get dragged into family stuff. But when she heard the podcast, she couldn't stay quiet anymore. Wentz arranged for her to testify in a sealed deposition, then contacted the district attorney. It was time. On July 18, 2025, a search warrant was executed at Mick Delgado's apartment in Yakima. Inside, officers found several burner phones, a duffel bag containing documents, and, most critically, an old hard drive. The drive had been reformatted, but the tech team recovered deleted files, including several emails from 2009. One stood out. It was a message to Ladina. "I did what you asked. You owe me. Don't pretend you're not in this too." Signed, M. Wentz now had evidence of conspiracy. He presented the full case file to the DA. Mick Delgado was arrested for obstruction of justice and fraud related to the use of Larry's funds. Ladina Mann was brought in for questioning under Miranda. When shown the evidence, financial records, emails, the TARP, her only response was, "You can't prove what you think you can." And for now, that's true. Without a full body, without a cause of death, without a confession, the case is still technically circumstantial, but Wentz is far from done. Because in Chapter 5, the investigation goes even deeper into the institutional apathy that allowed the case to go cold for 15 years, and the possible cover-up that might have protected Ladina longer than anyone suspected. Chapter 5, The Silence of Power. The deeper Detective Nolan Wentz dug into the Larry Regal case, the more he realized this wasn't just about a missing man, a panicked girlfriend, or a cover-up gone wrong. It was about something bigger, the kind of silence that only power can protect. Wentz wasn't a conspiracy theorist. He'd worked narcotics, gangs, even political corruption task forces. But in Larry's case, he kept running into something that felt less like coincidence and more like deliberate neglect. It wasn't just what was missing from the original 2010 investigation. It was who had refused to act. After securing the charges against Mick Delgado and Randy Harville, Wentz turned his attention to the early police files again. One name kept surfacing. Captain Ernest Daly, the officer in charge of Yakima PD's Missing Persons Division in 2009. Daly had been the one to downgrade Larry's case from missing under suspicious circumstances to voluntary disappearance. That reclassification had limited resource deployment, blocked forensic testing, and delayed any physical search of Larry's home for over 4 weeks. Wentz tracked Daly down at a retirement community outside Wapato. He brought a voice recorder and a printout of the case log. "Captain Daly, I'm revisiting the Larry Regal case," Wentz said, keeping his tone neutral. Daly's expression darkened. "That thing again? Thought that was buried years ago." "Wrong word," Wentz replied coldly. Why was the case downgraded just 48 hours after his family reported him missing, despite conflicting accounts from the girlfriend? Daly didn't answer at first. Then, with a shrug, "Domestic spat. Nothing we hadn't seen before. Man takes off, comes back. We didn't think it needed more." Wentz pushed. "No forensics? No interviews for 10 days? Her using his EBT card didn't raise red flags?" Daly finally snapped. "We had 4 murders that winter. Gangs, kids, bodies. You expect me to throw resources at a missing old guy with no signs of foul play?" Wentz leaned in. "What if I told you his body was under the shed the whole time?" Daly froze. "I'd say someone screwed up." But Wentz didn't believe it was just a screw-up. He went back to internal memos from 2010 and found something buried in the file stack. A written request from Karen Regal for cadaver dogs to search the property. Denied. The form was signed off not by the lead detective, but by a city administrator named Joel Whitney, who had no business interfering with a police investigation. Wentz pulled Whitney's employment file. He'd since moved to the Yakima County Prosecutor's Office, where he handled internal compliance reviews. Now things were getting political. Wentz paid Whitney a visit. In his office, clean, manicured, and guarded by frosted glass, Whitney wore a frozen smile. "I was asked to sign off on a resource allocation decision back then. Nothing more." "Who asked you?" "Captain Daly." "Why?" "He said the family was overreacting, that the case had no real merit." "But that wasn't your decision to make." Whitney's smile never cracked. "We were protecting departmental bandwidth." Wentz stared at him for a long moment, then left. Outside the building, he muttered under his breath, "Or maybe you were protecting someone else." That night, Wentz dug into Joel Whitney's connections, campaign donations, real estate holdings, public property records. And then he found something. Whitney had owned the storage lot where Larry's recliner, the one with bloodstains, was found dumped. He sold the lot in 2011, just months after the first wave of public pressure surrounding Larry's disappearance faded. It was circumstantial. But it was a thread, and Wentz was a man who pulled threads. He launched a quiet inquiry into who else might have been involved in suppressing Larry's case, not as accomplices in his death, but as enablers of the silence that followed. He discovered that Ladina had once been on disability aid administered by a department Whitney oversaw. She had received back pay under disputed circumstances in 2008. An audit flagged the transaction, but it was dismissed by a clerk under Whitney's division. If Ladina had something on Whitney, or if they had an arrangement, Larry's sudden disappearance could have threatened more than a relationship. It could have exposed misuse of state funds, fraud, or worse. Wentz filed a request with the Washington State Attorney General for a deeper audit into those years. Then came the anonymous email sent to the tip line Wentz had published during his podcast episode partnership. The message was brief. No subject line. No signature. Check the camera logs from December 26, 2009. Water Department van. Parked across the street. Recorded everything. PD was told to erase it. That night, Wentz pulled every archived traffic and utility cam record from that week. It took 48 hours to find the right one. And there it was, a street camera angle showing two men loading a large tarp-wrapped object into a van from Larry's house. The timestamp was 4:06 p.m., December 27th, 2009. The footage was corrupted halfway through, but it was enough to confirm the timeline. Someone had seen. Someone had recorded. And someone inside city operations had helped erase the truth. Wentz released a final press statement. This case wasn't just about Larry Regal. It was about what happens when the system is too willing to look away. We now have credible evidence of misconduct, cover-up, and obstruction reaching into multiple layers of public service. He didn't name names. Not yet. But subpoenas were issued. An ethics investigation was launched. And the whispers that had followed Larry's story for years were now on every front page. In a small memorial held on the grounds of Yakima City Square, Karen stood with photos of her brother, surrounded by candles and white roses. "This wasn't just a murder," she said. "It was a cover-up of a good man's life. But now, he's heard, and they're all finally seen." The crowd clapped. Some wept. Others just stood silent, the weight of truth finally pressing on a town that had let it hide for too long. Chapter 6. The Trap. By late September 2025, Detective Nolan Wentz knew one thing for certain. Ladina Mann was scared. Not of him, not of the law, but of someone she had once trusted. Every time she was brought in for questioning, her posture changed. She didn't look like a calculating manipulator anymore. She looked like a woman who knew a ghost was coming back to haunt her. Someone who had once helped her, now threatened her silence. Wentz suspected that the original cover-up wasn't just a family affair between Ladina and Mick Delgado. There had been another man, possibly one of the two movers seen at Larry's home after Christmas 2009, possibly someone involved with Ladina before Larry ever disappeared. And then he got the break he needed. In reviewing Larry's old files again, the digital forensic team recovered a scanned copy of an unsigned lease agreement. It was for a small commercial garage space on the east side of Yakima. The lease was in Larry's name, but the contact number listed wasn't his. It belonged to a man named Randy Harville, a part-time mechanic with a record for illegal firearms, assault, and suspiciously erased addresses. Wentz dug deeper. Randy had once dated Ladina, briefly, back in 2006. He had done off-the-books mechanic work for people using stolen parts. And he was known to move heavy items for cash, no questions asked. Wentz finally tracked him down in Kennewick, Washington. He didn't go in with a badge. He went in quiet. He wore plain clothes, sat at the end of a counter at a local dive bar, and waited. Eventually, Randy sat two stools over and ordered whiskey. Wentz introduced himself with a fake name. They talked about bikes, about weather, about old days. Then Wentz said one line that changed everything. "Crazy what they found under that shed in Yakima. You know that blue tarp's gonna put people away." Randy froze for a second, blinked, took a slow sip. Then he stood up, threw a 20 on the bar, and walked out. Fast. It was all Wentz needed. The next day, Wentz brought Randy in. No formal arrest, just a conversation. Randy was agitated, defensive. "I didn't kill nobody," he said. "You got the wrong guy." "I never said anyone was killed," Wentz replied. "I said the tarp was found." "And you ran." Randy's eyes flicked left, then right. "I didn't do nothing, just helped a friend move some stuff. Didn't ask questions." But Wentz leaned in. "Whose stuff?" Randy hesitated. "You know who." It was the first crack in the wall of silence. Randy claimed that in early January 2010, Ladina had called him in a panic, told him she needed a couch and a few items moved out of her house immediately, paid him in cash, told him not to look too closely at what was inside the tarp. He said it smelled weird, but didn't ask questions. He never saw Larry again. Wentz recorded the full statement. It wasn't a confession, but it was enough to open a conspiracy and evidence tampering charge. More importantly, it confirmed that Randy was the second man seen by the neighbor back in 2009. Wentz brought the neighbor Ed Curran in to review a current photo of Randy. Ed took one look and nodded. "That's him? That's the guy with the gloves and the tattoo." It was done. Wentz had verified movement of Larry's belongings by known associates, confirmed tampering of the crime scene, and uncovered a financial and digital paper trail linking everyone to the cover-up. But one more move remained. Wentz needed to turn the heat on Ladina. He filed formal charges, accessory to murder, financial exploitation, and conspiracy to obstruct justice. The media caught on immediately. Cameras swarmed the courthouse. Yakima was on fire with rumors. And then, the podcast released one final bombshell episode titled The Trap. In it, they laid out the entire timeline for the public. Larry's warning note. The suspicious EBT card use. The shifting alibis. The blue tarp. The shed. The burner phones. The hard drive. And finally, Randy's indirect confession. Ladina, now under legal siege, finally blinked. She requested a private meeting with Wentz and her lawyer. In the sterile silence of the Yakima Police Department's interrogation room, Ladina sat across from Wentz, her hands trembling slightly. Not from cold, from the weight of 15 years. "I didn't kill him," she said. "But I knew what happened. And I didn't stop it." Wentz leaned forward, quiet, no interruptions. She continued. "Larry found out about the money, the fake accounts. Mick was scared he'd go to the cops. He didn't mean to hurt him, not at first. But things got loud. There was a fight. I wasn't even in the room when it happened. I walked in and he was just laying there, not moving." "What did you do?" "I froze. Mick started shouting, said we needed to get help. Then Randy showed up. He looked at Larry, then at me, and said, 'Help means prison.' That's when they wrapped him, moved the couch, took him out."
"And you didn't stop them?"
"No."
"Why?"
"Because I thought I'd go down with them." Her confession was incomplete, protective, but it was enough. Enough to formally file for second-degree manslaughter, obstruction, and abuse of a corpse. Mick Delgado was charged as the primary suspect in Larry's death. Randy Harville was charged with evidence destruction and illegal disposal of remains. And for the first time in nearly 16 years, Karen Regal stood outside the courthouse in Yakima with tears in her eyes. Not from grief, but from relief. "They tried to bury the truth," she told reporters, "but Larry didn't disappear. He was taken, and now he's finally been heard." But one final mystery still hangs in the air.
Why was it so easy for everyone to look away? What systems, what people, and what choices allowed this case to go cold for so long? In Chapter 7, the final chapter, we uncover the institutional silence, the fumbled early investigation, and whether justice delayed can ever truly be justice served. Chapter 7, Justice Delayed. The Yakima courthouse buzzed with unfamiliar intensity on October 14, 2025. Reporters with notepads and camera crews jostled for position. Community members whispered in clusters near the courthouse steps, reading aloud the names printed on the arrest warrants: Mick Delgado, Randy Harville, Ladina Mann. Inside, Detective Nolan Wentz stood in the back of the courtroom, arms crossed, eyes fixed not on the judge or the prosecutor, but on the woman who had, for years, worn silence like armor. Ladina sat motionless. No tears, no expression, but her grip on the table trembled, slight but unmistakable. The charges, read aloud, echoed like thunder across a town that had almost forgotten Larry Regal ever existed. Second-degree manslaughter, Mick Delgado. Obstruction of justice and evidence tampering, Delgado, Harville, Mann. Abuse of a corpse, Harville. Accessory to homicide, Mann. Financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult, Mann. As the list grew, Ladena's eyes finally dropped to her lap. It had taken 15 years, 3 podcast episodes, 2 anonymous letters, and 1 determined detective to do what the original investigators failed to even begin. But why had it taken so long? That question haunted Detective Wentz more than any other. After the arraignment, he returned to the basement records room of the Yakima Police Department. The case file for Larry Regal had ballooned from a few thin pages to several folders thick. Yet the original documentation from 2010 was sparse, disjointed, lazy. No crime scene photos, no forensic sweeps, no subpoenas filed until months after his disappearance. No attempt to track the unidentified men seen removing items from Larry's home. And perhaps worst of all, no formal interview with Ladina Mann until weeks after Larry was reported missing. Wentz confronted Detective Ray Morgan, now retired, who led the original investigation. Morgan lived just outside Spokane in a modest ranch house. Wentz brought a recorder, but what he got instead was a confession without remorse. "I didn't think it was a homicide," Morgan said. "Guy didn't show up for a few days. No signs of a struggle. The girlfriend seemed calm, so I marked it as a domestic issue. Thought he'd come back. But she used his benefits, lied about when he left, changed her story." "I've worked 30 years in this state, son. People lie doesn't make them killers." Wentz leaned in. "You know what makes people killers?" Morgan didn't answer. "Time. Time and the assumption that no one's watching." It wasn't just one man's negligence. It was a system of dismissal. A low-income, middle-aged man goes missing. No high profile, no pressure, no outrage. His case wasn't even entered into the National Crime Information Center until 7 months later. Wentz submitted an internal report to the state's Department of Justice, citing systemic lapses in investigative procedure. While it wouldn't change Larry's fate, it might prevent the next case from being shelved so easily. He also made a quiet phone call to Karen Regal. "We're not just closing your brother's case," he said. "We're fixing the system that buried it." Karen had no words, just tears. 3 weeks later, Mick Delgado accepted a plea deal. In exchange for testifying truthfully and providing a full account of the night Larry died, the charge was reduced from second-degree murder to involuntary manslaughter with a 15-year sentence. Mick's confession was recorded in court, under oath. It wasn't supposed to happen like that. Larry found out about the money. He got loud. I pushed him. He hit his head on the corner of the table. I didn't know he was dead until we tried to wake him, Mom panicked. Called Randy. We wrapped him up. I didn't know what else to do. When asked if he had any final words, Mick looked down. I was trying to protect my mom, but I destroyed a good man's life. Randy Harville, after being shown a stack of messages tying him to the tarp and a sealed forensic report proving the blood was Larry's, took a separate plea. 8 years for obstruction and improper disposal of human remains. He never spoke in court. And Ladina Mann? She took the longest to break. Weeks passed before she finally stood before the judge and delivered her statement. Not an apology. Not a sobbing confession. Just a cold string of words wrapped in self-preservation. I didn't kill Larry, but I didn't help him either. I chose silence over truth, and for that, I am accountable. The judge sentenced her to 12 years for accessory charges and financial exploitation, denying her probation. She was led away in shackles. The courtroom cleared, cameras flashed, reporters typed furiously. But outside, in the chill of a Yakima morning, Karen Regal stood alone, quiet, her breath fogging in the air. Larry's case was officially closed, not with the full body found, not with justice as swift as it should have been, but with truth unearthed and silence finally broken. She left a single white flower at the edge of the shed where her brother had been hidden all those years. "Rest now," she whispered. "They can't hurt you anymore."